Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that, though this is no time for sound bites, can feel the hand of history upon its shoulder. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and this is a special episode reflecting on 20 years since New Labour came to power on May the 1st, 1997. It's a longer episode than usual, which is good as most of it is going to be spent introducing the people with me today. Five of us gathered in the nuclear bunker in which we're hiding from the general election at the moment. I've tried to work out our equivalent in New Labour figures. So, the Gordon Brown, I think, who runs Birmingham Fabians, like Gordon Brown, there's a small group of dedicated followers, is the great clunking fist of Luke Don Davis.
Hello.
Tony Blair, whose priorities are education, 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 but not wanted for war crimes yet, is Bridget Jones.
Give me time.
She's the one going to lead the invasion of Spain.
With three cabinet jobs in 4 years at Birmingham City Council, I think obviously John Reid of course had seven cabinet jobs in 8 years, but John Reid must be Councillor John Cotton.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
Just stolen my opening.
Boom!
They'll never notice. The Prince of Darkness. Who else could be Peter Mandelson other than my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes?
Hi, Corey. Still don't know if that's a compliment or an insult.
Neither am I. I think I decided that I was probably Estelle Morris, who resigned because she wasn't up to the job. I wasn't looking for sympathy. It was just.
You could be Claire Short.
It's hardly an improvement.
Surely you'd be James Purnell, constantly in the back row and working hard, and then just one minor mistake, and then you just aren't able to continue in a career.
20 years ago, New Labour came to power. A new dawn had broken, had it not?
That's a great line.
It is, yeah. Isn't it? There was talk of creating a progressive century and making Labour the natural party of government. For all of New Labour's achievements, that vision doesn't quite seem to have worked out the way that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown would have wanted. In this episode, we discuss the successes and failures of New Labour and the premiership of the greatest Prime Minister of the first decade of the 21st century. So, in preparation for this podcast, I reread Chris Mullin's diaries. Chris Mullin was the chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee and was a junior minister. And in it, he quotes an article by, of all people, Andrew Gilligan, that New Labour was a moderately successful social democratic party. So, why then are they so hated?
Iraq?
I think it's a combination of the three I's that we haven't been forgiven for: Iraq, immigration, and inequality. One of the issues with Iraq was that we went with WMD's claim rather than with the kind of genocide that Saddam Hussein was committing. So that's been one thing. And I think the fact that we haven't stopped attacking our own government. For all of the disaster that John Major presided over, you never heard the Conservatives slagging him off.
I'd go for a slightly different three I's. I'd go for Iraq, infighting, and impossible expectations. Iraq, we all know the story there. The infighting was terrible towards the end. The last couple of years, maybe, of Blair's premiership were blighted by infighting and the question of when will he go. And then impossible expectations. You know, Labour had come in after a very long period of Conservative government in the same way as hopes were incredibly high for Obama. We've seen recently hopes were incredibly high for Labour. There was no way they could possibly deliver on every hope that was pinned on them. And they were bound to disappoint in some way.
I think there's real irony there in that there was an awful lot of trying to manage expectations in the run-up to 97. You know, having gone through four defeats, trying not to frighten the horses, as it were. So, you know, really trying to manage expectations down to the five things on the pledge card. But you're quite right, it was almost like a dam broke. Partly, the victory was so wide-ranging, you know, such a landslide. Then all these expectations have been pent up for many years, kind of broke out. And we were kind of ill-prepared, I think, to deal with that. And we were still in a rather small-c conservative mindset about how to govern. And the expectations massively outstripped what we then went on to do.
And I suppose the problem is you've got such a wide range of voters who are voting for you. You're going to disappoint some of them. The hardcore Labour vote, you've got your white working class. You've also got places, people in places like Hove who've probably never voted Labour before. Some seats never went Labour until 1997. And it's an impossible coalition to keep together.
And there's never the expectation, I think, that we'd win on that scale. So, you know, I think the moment when we won Hove, there were people wandering around the election party I was at going, we've won Hove, this is just bloody impossible. Certainly, if you read the diaries, that was echoed on the plane journey they were having down to London, where it's like, you know, you're taking the mick now. We can't possibly have won these places. We were handed such a mandate, we hadn't prepared for the scale of a victory like that and the expectations it unleashed.
Well, we later found out we prepared for a Lib Dem coalition.
Mm.
That's how different the expectations were.
It's really impossible to underestimate just how scarred that generation of Labour leaders was by the experience of the 80s and the experience of losing four elections in a row. So we had, you know, almost time kind of took... present the smallest possible target. I mean, it's the classic Roy Jenkins phrase, isn't it, when he described Blair as carrying the ornate vase across a highly polished floor and hoping he doesn't drop it. And that really, I think, governed the mindset, certainly of the early part of that Labour government.
There's a quote in one of Chris Mullin's diaries where someone says, to understand Blair, you've got to understand that he comes from Hackney in the 80s, which is basically the point of view that the Labour Party is always wrong. Actually, Blair was proved wrong in that view over Iraq, where he goes into Iraq, most Labour members don't want it. A lot of Labour MPs don't want it. He manages to, as the Chilcot inquiry basically says, manages to shackle himself very, very closely to who we all thought was going to be the most disastrous US president of our lifetimes before, you know, everything else.
And those were the days.
oh, for a statesman in the White House.
It is worth remembering, though, that Blair did win a fairly decent majority in 2005, 2 years after Iraq.
But Blair, I think, tried to be very, very close to Bush in order to try and influence Bush on Iraq and go through the UN and get any... One of the things that Blair wanted to try and get out of Bush through staying really close to him with the Iraq stuff was a Middle East peace process, which basically got waylaid. There was no planning for what would happen in Iraq after Saddam Hussein left. And also, I slightly disagree with your point, LJ, on responsibility for protect, if only because, actually, if you read the diaries and read the accounts, Blair does do a lot of the moral case for going in and removing dictators. I mean, there was the Chicago speech in 1999. He's going around speaking to Parliament about how Saddam is an evil guy and should be gotten rid of. I think the case was made.
But that wasn't the main case given at that moment publicly. In time. So yeah, absolutely, the Chicago Doctrine or whatever call it these days does definitely focus on that element. But at the end of the day, it was all about that. In 45 minutes, they can do this.
I mean, that was certainly the bit that the media picked up on. I think one of the issues around Iraq is you've also got to remember, you talk about where Blair came from and Hackney in the 80s, but you also have to remember, in terms of international affairs, the two defining international affairs of Blair's early leadership or training was Rwanda and Srebrenica. Both instances, the international community, NATO, was pilloried. And I researched into responsibility to protect and the origins of it, where the French rescued the embassy dog and left the Rwandan embassy staff to be massacred. That's the kind of atmosphere in which Blair came to prominence in terms of when he was kind of looking at international affairs. And that was his thing. And also, you know, Sierra Leone, Kosovo, there was examples of successful interventions. It's quite hard to blame Blair for Iraq. I don't think anybody here would say that if Blair had said no, the Americans would not have gone in. Everything that happened in Iraq would have happened regardless of whether we were there or whether it was the Americans on their own. But I think the other thing to remember is at the time in 2003, even the UN believed there was still weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Hans Blix was pleading for more time to find them, not saying he didn't think they were there. The case at the time was, should we go in now or should we give the UN inspector there's more time to find these WMDs.
I suppose it was a weird case of a bluff where Saddam was bluffing that he didn't have them when he had.
And I mean, we knew he had them. He'd used them on the Marshall Arab, he'd used them on the Kurds. The mistake there was in that focus. The other thing to remember is that it had public support. If you look at the opinion polls, which I did in the run-up to this podcast, there was a fairly steady number against, a fairly steady number for, and a huge chunk in the middle of neutral. opinions or not sure up until just before, and then there was the kind of rally around the flag, and actually the support for it all was well over 50%, or just over, at least just over 50%.
I think Blair's got this messianic ability to believe that he can persuade anyone of anything at any time, and I think he probably overestimated his ability to influence Bush for a positive sense in Iraq, and I think that's why he tied Britain very, very closely to the American point of view.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if you think about, say, what Thatcher would have done with Reagan, Thatcher would have said, we are not going in unless you do A, B, C. And from what we can tell of the conversations that Blair had with Bush, Blair never actually did that and was never as strict as maybe he could have been. The eye of immigration, which you mentioned, I think is an interesting one, because there was never really a positive case that was consistently made for immigration. It was always done on the sly. It was never really made out as a good thing. It was almost just seen as an inevitable thing about the modern world, a sort of inevitable way of modernising.
There's almost a degree of stealth mark several parts of the whole New Labour policy agenda. So, you know, there's tremendous amounts of good that was done around redistribution of wealth, but it was done in a rather stealthy way. We never talked openly around the merits of redistribution and how the benefits of society were more fairly shared out. It was always done kind of under the radar. I think we got into a whole set of policy agendas that were done in a less than clear and direct way, and that had political ramifications. I mean, the thing that particularly strikes me is if you look at, I mean, communities like I represent in Shard End, which should really be, you know, kept the faith of voting Labour through the days when manufacturing industry was collapsing and jobs are going. And I don't think, for all the good that government did, and, you know, I'm a great fan of much of what that government did, it never really articulated a alternative offer to those communities. It didn't replace the jobs in the same way. It didn't meet a lot of the other challenges that people in places like Chardin felt they were facing. At its worst, got into a slightly sniffy and patronising approach to those communities, as if, well, you're only saying that because you're racist or you don't understand. And that's the kind of dangerous spaces that it got into. And I think you can see the seeds of some of the disconnect between those communities that we're now seeing played out in the context of this general election. They actually date back to that period. And that's notwithstanding the fact that there's an awful lot of, you know, decent investment that went into schools, into public services, and into opportunities that helped a lot of people.
I think I agree with you completely on that, John. And I think the other thing to realise is that during this time, both the Labour Party and the people the Labour Party appealed to became the professionals, not the working class. So as you sort of moved through the 90s, they almost kind of banked the working class and thought there was nowhere else for them to go. And what they were appealing to, you know, was mundane man. It was your aspirational, your middle class. It was professionals. And now that's kind of come home to roost in a sense, in that, you know, we lost that idea of communitarianism, in my view, was the greatest mistake of the Labour government in 97 to 2010, although, like you, I'm a massive fan of what they did. But I think that we overemphasised equality and forgot about solidarity.
As you say, a lot of New Labour doing good through stealth. And I suppose inequality is maybe one of those things. So, for instance, raising national insurance to pay for health was a very, very good progressive policy, but one that wasn't really trumpeted and one that wasn't really repeated. There was this fixation on never raising income tax, which, I mean, it led to the doubling of 10p tax, I suppose, on the poorest, which was something that happened in the dog days. It happened in Gordon Brown's last budget as Chancellor, basically so he could cut 2p off the top rate of tax and get a decent headline.
Two difficulties that arise from the kind of doing good by stealth. One is that you never make a really powerful argument for why redistribution matters and why it's important. So you don't shift the political argument sufficiently. Problem number two is that you then end up with designing incredibly fiendishly complicated systems in some cases to actually engineer the redistribution. So you think of how complicated parts of the tax credit system became, I mean, to the point where it became quite unmanageable in an administrative sense for doing that. So, and that then leads you into you move it further away from the whole system. You put something in to get something out, the whole reciprocal thing starts to break down, and so it then becomes very easy to challenge that redistribution. I think, you know, we've now seen how that policy agenda has played out since Labour lost power in 2010 and the kind of unravelling of a whole set of those redistributive mechanisms.
It was focused around not giving the Murdoch press the ability to write headlines about taxes people had actually heard of. So it was stealth taxes, almost.
I think when it comes down to the inequality, though, one of the biggest issues is just down to the perception of how New Labour dealt with the issue of inequality rather than the actual outcome itself. Mandelson and his quote about basically we're completely fine with people being filthy, sinking rich.
Which was only the first half of the sentence.
I know.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is the thing, the perception of that, that's what sticks in people's minds. Yeah. So I think when it comes to inequality, you know, when you actually look at the stats and the figures and things like that, it's not a bad situation. There's investment in the right areas. But it made it look like Labour was really, really comfortable with the rich and therefore would never consider actually taxing them.
Mm.
And we didn't talk about inequality, we talked about social exclusion.
You know, we didn't do enough around inequality. We did a huge, huge amount. I mean, you know, tax credits kept me and my mum and brothers in a house when my parents split up. And the minimum wage allowed both me and both my brothers to live out, move out and have lives. But, you know, real wages did stagnate from 2004. We did get obsessed almost too much with university and higher education and the 50% target to the point that we removed careers from the other half. And it's continued since. And, you know, you now need a degree to become a police officer. You need a degree to become a nurse. I mean,
it's an interesting one, the 50% at university, because it wasn't actually plucked out of thin air like most people think it was. It came out of a study that was done looking at what skill set we would need for us to perform well as a future economy. And the calculation that was done was that you needed 50% of school leavers now to be going to university to give us the skill set for the economy in the future.
Mm.
But that evidence base, you know, there could have been a solid story to sell there, but instead, because we didn't articulate what the other 50% would be doing, it went badly.
I think with that, it was also a question. It became, the focus was, let's just get people a degree rather than the right degrees in that instance. Because with any report of that nature, I've not read it, but I can always take a guess that it would have been highlighting STEM, which are increasingly and ever more so going to be the drivers behind more developed nations' economies. Instead, what we got is degrees in leisure and tourism. That's not to say they're not necessarily real degrees. It's not to say that they're not valid, they're not useful, but their application in terms of furthering growth is much more limited.
The Blair thesis in a journey is that Labour could still have won in 2010 if it had governed as New Labour. But after Gordon Brown took power, they did not govern as New Labour and therefore fell off the rails and lost. Do you think there is a way that Labour could have won in 2010? Could it have been like the equivalent of 1992 for the Conservatives? Or is it just that it was a party that had gone to the end of the road that had that infighting? We haven't talked about infighting yet, that other eye, but was it a party that had run its course?
I'm not convinced that just the simple act of governing like New Labour under Brown would have actually led to an outright victory. One thing that's oftentimes is actually massively overlooked is that it wouldn't have happened without Blair. The landslide wouldn't have happened without that charismatic figure right at the forefront. You know, Gordon Brown could have done everything in the exact same way Tony Blair would have done, but he's still not Tony Blair. He lacks that charisma. He lacks that kind of ability to act as a unifying figurehead in some ways. The idea that somehow if, I don't know, Gordon Brown had tacked a little bit more to the centre, had triangulated a bit more, that he would have somehow ended up winning in 2010, I'm not convinced by. If Gordon Brown had played things slightly differently, would we have been in a situation where the Lib Dem Labour coalition was a bit more feasible? Maybe. But the issue there is that, on the Labour side at least, the support from a lot of senior figures wasn't there, so it probably wouldn't have made a difference anyway. In a lot of ways, Labour had just kind of run out of steam. Blair might have been able to even eke out one more win. But the actual focus and the real idea generation behind New Labour would have not been up to scratch. It would have been the last legs of a dying government from day one of that new administration.
I think there's two things to remember here. First of all is that we did fight to a creditable draw
absolutely.
In 2010. And I think, you know, with all due respect to Comrade Steve, if the Lib Dems hadn't rescued David Cameron, it could have been the 92 for the Tories. But I think the other thing...
I don't think the arithmetic was there for anything else, though, was it?
No, but I think we, you know, anyway...
Point of order, Mr. Sheffield.
No, I think, you know, a support for a minority government or something like that could have seen it turn into a 92. But the other thing that we've not mentioned here, right, is that in 2008, the whole neoliberal thesis fell to its knees. You know, New Labour was predicated on accepting the right's economic story, which is why we did stealth taxes, which is why we didn't talk about solidarity and we focused on the individual. We didn't have a story to replace it with because we hadn't had our own economic story since the 70s, which was equally discredited. And that's actually something Labour still has now, right? One of the things about New Labour was about renewal. Blair himself has come out and said what worked in 97 wouldn't work now. So whether Blair would have been able to have the intellectual fleet-footedness or other people around him, I mean, Philip Gould had died by then, who I think is a hugely underrated figure in Labour history, but whether there was that there to do that renewal in office, that's a possibility as to how Labour could have done it. Gordon Brown self-evidently didn't have that fleet-footedness to renew the New Labour project in office.
We're sat here celebrating what happened 20 years ago and Tony Blair winning in 1997. We're not here celebrating what happened 10 years ago, which could have been Gordon Brown winning in 2007. That's where it all went wrong.
And that, I think, yeah, it's... That was the point where he could have won. I think he could have won quite well, and then the history subsequently could have been rather different. I think the other thing is that, you know, when we talk about that Labour government coming to an end after three election wins, actually trying to get the fourth election win is a pretty difficult thing to do. You know, only one person has ever done it, and that was in 92, and we know how that ended for the Tories. So the fact that we got to that creditable score draw in 2010, I think actually speaks to the credit of how that government conducted itself.
That does go back to what I was saying. The Tories did renew themselves in office, right? Between 1990 when Thatcher went down and 1992 when Major won, they did renew themselves. We've seen exactly the same thing happen now. And between David Cameron stepping down over Brexit and now, the Conservative government has renewed itself office.
I think that's kind of the main thing, though, there, is that between Thatcher and Major and between Cameron and May, is there's a massive shift in terms of the people who are actually involved in terms of the upper echelons. There's a different sort of ideological thought being brought in, which, because of the nature of the Blair-Brown relationship, meant that Brown was always involved to a large extent with all of those stuff. So there wasn't a shift to be had, really. Mm. It was just continuation. When you're talking about the potential kind of growth or kind of getting that fourth term, I think the actual outcome was more or less decided when Brown was chosen as leader. He was yesterday's man. Mm. He was only there because basically Tom Watson, Ed Balls and all of that forced out Blair and managed to wrangle it so that most of the talent just got killed in a lot of ways.
I think the really shocking thing, though, about Brown's ascendancy was just how little there was on the kind of vision and to-do list for somebody who'd waited so long to get there. And I think that's the thing that really surprises me. Incidentally, I'm not, you know, a complete downer on Brown, because I think when history comes to be written in the longer term, you look back on what he did in 2008 in response to the financial crisis.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he's absolutely to his credit, and he was the man who was needed to be there at the time. It's just by that point, I think he'd shot so much of his credibility with the public, he was never going to get the payback that he deserved for that when it came to the electorate.
I think Brown's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think history will look on him fairly kindly, partly for the bailout of the banks, I think also for keeping Britain out of the euro. The Labour Party, bless it, tends to pick the wrong leaders and then hold on to them for too long. And I think perhaps Brown is quite a good example of that as well. If you read Chris Mullin's diaries from mid-2006 up until 2007, where Blair steps down, you have a succession of conversations with other backbenchers, other cabinet ministers, who are basically saying, well, we don't think Gordon's up to being prime minister. We think he's not got the right personality. But there was no other candidate, partly because people like Alan Milburn, Brown's team squashed.
James Purnell.
James Purnell is another good example. David Miliband didn't seem up for it.
Absolutely just bottled it himself.
He didn't have a story to tell because he was always chasing initiatives, lots and lots of endless initiatives, and just, as I alluded to in the introduction, he had a very small team around him, and when he became Prime Minister, people like Ed Balls, Danny Alexander, Ed Miliband, they were in the cabinet. They couldn't help run Downing Street because they already had ministerial jobs to go to. And actually, if you hear about Brown's office, there's stories of phones not being answered and emails not being answered in the same way that there are of Corbyn's office now. And I think it's a similar problem in that you've got a leader with a really small group, a bunker mentality of people who, quite frankly, wasn't up to the job. He was a good chancellor, because he had time to think. When you're a prime minister, you've got everything coming at you from all angles. He just couldn't cope.
For the record, although we're currently all in a bunker, we are all really good at our jobs. Just wanted to
clarify. I'm a dirty PhD student, so I don't have a job to be good at. But no, but I think the other thing to remember about Gordon Brown, right, is if you take it back, right, he was the ideas man in a lot of cases. And then him and Blair would talk and beat out ideas. The slogan, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, was an exact perfect example of that. There was a lot of hard slog before the slogan. Blair and Brown were the Lennon and McCartney. And everybody loves John Lennon, but he couldn't have done it without Paul McCartney.
It's John Prescott bingo.
John Prescott was in a league of his own.
Benefit of hindsight stuff, isn't it? But frankly, if there'd been a leadership contest in 94 in which Brown had stood and lost to Blair, because I think it would have made the TBGBs a lot less fractious because there'd been a clear decision taken. And I also think it would have made Brown a stronger politician by having had to face that internal election and challenge. And equally in 2007, this goes back to the point around Labour renewing itself in office, you know, what we needed was actually a leadership election like we had when Wilson went, when you had some serious big hitters. You know, you think of the cast list of that 76 election, it's Healy, it's Benn, it's Foote, it's Callaghan, it's Crossland. We didn't have the same kind of, anything near that kind of debate.
After that point as well, the kind of the next generation, as we've kind of talked about already, were of the professional politician class. It's the Ed Ballses, the Miller Bands, the former Spads. And again, despite being one of the best performers from the New Labour years, the likes of Alan Johnson, for whatever reason, never really got the time of day to actually be pushed forward in the way that, regardless of whether like Brown was Prime Minister or still Shadow Chancellor, if you got some form of dynamic with, say, Johnson there, with his kind of much more focus from coming up through from as you said, through the community, through the actual Labour movement, through the unions, versus Gordon Brown's initiative focus, that kind of constant, you'll probably get a reasonably successful mesh of how to run a government. Because of the way that Gordon Brown and his team had acted, there was no one really to step up into that role, and even the ones who could have, like, say, Alan Johnson, didn't want to, because probably the experience of actually being in government and working with those people meant they just thought it wasn't worth it.
And the other thing that you're now suffering from now, right, is you look at that generation, I think Yvette Cooper's the last one standing, right? There is a gap in the PLP. James Purnell, Hazel Bleers, David Miliband, they've all gone. Ed Ball's lost his seat. Ed Miliband is...
failed leader.
Yeah, busted flush, essentially. Kind of elder statesman generation of MPs is just missing. And the only one left is Yvette Cooper.
What lessons do you think we can take from New Labour's time in government? We've touched on a few. Are there any specifically that we haven't yet that maybe we can mention?
To me, right, the big thing about New Labour that is dramatically missing from the Labour Party now is that they wanted to take control from the Conservatives. They didn't want the Conservatives to just drop the ball. People say, oh, you know, a pig in a red rosette would have won in 97, you know. My dad is convinced that John Smith is the best Prime Minister we never had. Actually, I'm dubious as to whether John Smith would necessarily have won. It was inherently reactive to the Conservatives, right? We thought, as we had under Ed Miliband, as we've had under Corbyn, that if we told people often enough that the Tories were bad, they would vote for us instead. Whereas New Labour said, right, the Tories renew themselves in office. We've seen them do it in 92. We need to wrest control from their resisting fingers. We need to take it from them. They are not going to surrender it.
I have a slightly different take on the would we have won without Blair in 97. I actually think the Tories had so screwed themselves, frankly, through Black Wednesday, also just the attrition of being in for four terms, and of course all the other toxic stuff that had built up, which hadn't quite broken the dam for them, you know, poll tax and everything else. We probably would have won still in 97, and I think Smith would have been a credible, reliable, stoic bank manager type that people like John Smith. And actually one of the outpouring of grief when he died, you know, which was shared kind of across the people, was quite something at that point. But I do think where the difference would have been is that we wouldn't have won as resoundingly, and I don't think we'd have governed for as long. Because I think we would have, that there would have been different decisions, I think, potentially taken around Europe, different approaches in certain areas of policy that would perhaps not have been as appealing to the Middle England electorate that we held on for as long as we did. and I think the Tories would have been in a stronger position to come back sooner.
Because I thought the two lessons that maybe Labour would learn, one of them maybe is a little one and one of them is maybe a bigger one to talk about. One of them is about reshuffles, the amount of reshuffles that were done. Blair wasn't really one for thinking about junior ministerial roles. There were often annual reshuffles. I mean, we talked about John Reid's 7 jobs in 8 years. There's just no way that you can have an adequate brief and get briefed on the issues in that time. And I suppose the other thing is how you try and manage the media. Because I suppose New Labour, now imagine this, young listeners, there wasn't such a thing as Twitter in 1997.
Hashtag shocked.
There wasn't Facebook or any of those social media things you have now. The period where Labour's in power from 97 to 2010, that's when you see the growth of social media, you see the growth of 24-hour news and that and cable news. I think it's almost like the first test of a government trying to work out how to do politics in that environment. Part of the reason there were so many initiatives, so many reshuffles, so much spinning, is because they were trying to handle that media coverage. Anyone who thinks that media bias against Labour somehow started in September 2015 maybe needs to remember the Sun headlines that called Blair the most dangerous man in Britain, maybe thinks about how they said Downing Street, how Britain was being run by a gay mafia. Also, do you remember the stuff about Gordon Brown, his letters to servicemen? There was a big manufactured row in the Sun because he'd written a letter of condolence and it looked like he'd not spent very long writing it, because they ignore the fact that he could barely see and was blind in one eye. And so there's a lot of media hostility that they tried to tame. And later Labour in opposition in government will have to think of a way of trying to handle the media in a slightly different way. I think New Labour tried one way, but that wasn't working by the end of Brown's time in number 10.
Well, Twitter, Facebook and YouTube all became mainstream in between 2005 and 2010. The game completely changed. In that very short period of time.
YouTube, if you want to. There's Hazel Blair's thing. Sorry, Hazel.
Oh, was that Hazel Blair's?
It was Hazel Blair's. Well, it was Paul Richards, technically, who her spouse wrote it.
And interestingly, actually, for those who sort of say that you know, Blair was a deviation from Labour history, you know, the 24th of October 1900, and people first stand for election under a Labour Party banner.
I wasn't involved in that election.
That was just before you joined, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Keir Hardie in Merthyr Tydfil wins on three pledges, right? The first one was a minimum wage, the second one was home rule for Scotland, and the third was prohibition of alcohol. Now, you know, who was the Prime Minister who introduced the minimum wage? It was Tony Blair. Who was the Prime Minister who gave devolution to Scotland? It was Tony Blair. Now, okay, he didn't ban alcohol, but two out of three of them isn't bad. You
know? It turns out Keir Hardie was a Tory all along. So
he had been a one-term government.
Yeah, exactly.
But that moves us on, doesn't it? So, John, what do you think was Labour's finest achievement in government? Let's go on to that.
I mean, there's so much, actually, to choose from. In terms of equality, in terms of the minimum wage, in terms of redistribution, notwithstanding my criticisms around the slightly stealthy way it was done, I think there's a whole set of things absolutely to the merit around how we shifted the debate around social issues. So, you know, our approaches to issues around homosexuality, all of that great liberal legislation as well, I think, greatly to the credit of the government. But I think that the real thing for me is that it proved that it is possible for the Labour Party and the centre-left to win an extended period in government and change the country. And in doing so, actually change the opposition as well. Because if you think of the Tory party that was booted out in 97, and some of the very unreconstructed attitudes that still existed in that party in 97, compared to the agenda that Cameron and the others were starting to articulate when the Tories eventually hobbled back in over the line in 2010. That was an extraordinary change in terms of attitudes. So that was the big achievement. The big failure is that we didn't sustain that achievement and make the 21st century the progressive century that we said we were going to.
I think the interesting thing with what John's just said there is even when you look at the May government, the a lot of the right wing kind of Tories these days, many of which were still from that period, so much of their attitudes has shifted in an awful lot of ways. And the ones that are unreformed, for lack of a better term, your Philip Davies, for instance, are
no relation.
are in many ways just a kind of a bit of a laughing stock, and often just meant poked fun at by the media as a whole, not just the left wing media.
The really obvious example in terms of how Labour changed the Conservative Party is that in 15 odd years the Conservatives went from supporting Section 28 to introducing equal marriage.
Absolutely.
Well, and going from opposing the minimum wage in 98 to introducing a living wage
Not a substantial increase on the minimum wage.
The fact they feel they need to do it, and also I suppose you could talk about investment in public services. Although you've got that austerity narrative, the fact that there was the need to ring fence NHS spending, there at least needs to be a token commitment to the idea that you invest in public services.
Human Rights Act was a huge thing. Tax credits, as I say, you know, me when my parents split up, me and my brothers and my mum were able to stay in our house because of tax credits, and because she was able to go back to work for the NHS. Because of the investment that was coming into the public services in 2000 when that happened. One policy that I would pick out would be the minimum wage.
Children's services. The 2004 Children's Act changed fundamentally the way that children's services operated and the way that education operated, and really put front and centre the needs of children and just the idea of investing heavily, not just money-wise, but also mentally in that next generation. It was a massive piece of evidence-based policy, looking at the science behind child development and the science behind making an impact on their lives. And we have a generation that's benefited from it. It's really sad seeing that systematically taken apart by the current government.
I am quite impressed with the fact as well, we've probably talked about this for 5 or 10 minutes and we haven't mentioned the Good Friday Agreement and peace in Northern Ireland as well.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Which was pretty good.
Yeah, and ending a 70-year-old civil war was a fairly decent pitch.
People afterwards, I think, try to say it was John Major started it, but when you read the accounts and you see how much Blair threw himself into it and really put his credibility on the line after only about a year as Prime Minister, I think it's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. Well, we look forward to joining you in maybe 40, 45 years when we can celebrate 20 years of the anniversary of the next Labour government.
Led by Bridget.
Only after an open contest.
We're back on Sunday with more election talk. We'll be having lots of podcasts about the general election and all the campaigning in the run-up. Before we go, though, our theme tune is Pucky Good Times by Dave Depper. That's on freemusicarchive.org. And our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at LJ Davies 87, Davies with an E.
At Bridget Jones, Bridget spelled the dodgy Irish way.
I'm at Centre Radical.
At Councillor John Cotton.
That's all. Just remember, things can only get better.
Please tell me that that will be the play-out music at the end.
The relic, this is great podcasting.
Yeah.
I brought a visual aid to a podcast.
For those of you watching in black and white,
the copy of progress is in red.
So I brought my Progress magazine celebrating the 20 years since Blair, which I got signed by Peter Mandelson, which I used to ward off.
Horcrux, I think. And I think
this is Peter Mandelson's Horcrux.